So how do you know for sure that you're in love? Well, you get an MRI. As far-fetched as that may seem, in a research paper that was presented October 7, 2000 in New Orleans at the Society for Neuroscience, a study revealed that 17 subjects went through functional MRIs and they were shown a series of pictures, and when the picture of the person that they were in love with appeared, then there were four brain areas that lit up showing extra brain activity. Not only did that show who they were in love with, but other areas of the brain that typically report anxiety were dormant when the person whom they love was shown on the photograph. So love is good. And love and marriage, even better. Last August in Washington, D.C., was a gathering of the American Sociological Association, and a much larger study was there presented about marriage, saying that over a five-year period, getting married or staying married reduces symptoms of depression far more than being single or divorced. And it must be married, not living together. There are no health benefits to cohabitation. In fact, even unhappy marriages indicate mental health benefits. Unhappily married partners get less of a mental health boost than the happily wed, but they still fare better overall than the singles or the divorced. So love and marriage, good in a powerful combination. Good for happiness, good for health, good for effectiveness. But not always the ideal that we would dream that love and marriage should be. In the worst of times, there is an epidemic of failed marriages within an entire society or culture, where there is lust instead of love, where people are more likely to live together than to be married, where selfishness and sexual promiscuity overtake love and faithfulness, where it becomes the worst of times for love in the marriage relationship. Perhaps there was no time as bad as the first century Roman Empire. Historians have analyzed the many, many documents throughout the history of the Roman Empire and have discovered that in the first 500 years of the empire, there was no recorded divorce, that the first divorce of record was in the year 234 BC. But then the numbers began to increase until by the first century, divorce was so rampant that the institution of marriage itself was significantly at risk. Toward the eastern end of the empire in Palestine, Jewish girls knew that it was so likely that they would get an easy divorce forced upon them that many of them simply refused to marry in the first place. The Greeks were so frivolous about marriage that one writer says that home and family life were near to being extinct and fidelity was completely non-existent. And the Romans? The Romans weren't much better. By the first century, they were dating events in their biographies not by a number, but by a marriage partner. One woman reports that she was, in one particular year, married to her 23rd husband, and she was his 21st wife. And so she remembered the years by the names of the husbands to which she was married. Now, in the midst of these worst of times, St. Paul wrote a revolutionary concept of Christian marriage. It was so different that it must have caught their attention, and some must have thought of it as absolutely bizarre. A message of purity rather than promiscuity, of love rather than lust, that a person would be devoted to a marriage partner rather than simply using a marriage partner for convenience and dumping that person when it became inconvenient. And so a revolution began to take place as Christians adopted a totally different paradigm. Couple by couple, year by year, generation by generation, eventually the entire empire was transformed. So here's what St. Paul wrote that was so revolutionary. It's in Ephesians 5. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish. but holy and blameless. In this same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated his own body, but he feeds and cares for it just as Christ does the church, for we are members of his body. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. However, each one of you also must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. When I was a graduate student in Denver, my wife Charlene worked at the Mountain States Bank, and among her responsibilities was to keep a lookout for counterfeit currency. I recall that we had a discussion, I think it came out of a newspaper article, on the training of Secret Service agents to identify counterfeit bills. The article had indicated that the primary focus of the training is not on the counterfeits, but on the genuine article, the assumption being that you could spend the rest of your life looking at the many variations of counterfeiting. What you really needed to know well was the genuine article. And Charlene indicated that that was her experience. She spent all day, 8 hours a day, playing with money. It's one of the few times in her life she's been able to do that. And she said that when she saw a counterfeit bill, she could just sense that it was different. It just looked different. It wasn't what she was used to seeing. A comparison can be made to marriage, where within our society and other cultures as well, so much attention has been given to that which has failed and that which is broken, to the celebrity calamities of marriage or the tragedies that have occurred, that we no longer understand what it could be or what it should be or what the genuine article looks like. That is what the New Testament does. It does not focus upon the difficulties of failed marriages, but rather presents the view of what a Christian marriage within love for a husband and wife is intended to be. The words that were first spoken to husbands can be applied to Christian wives as well. That is to love your spouse just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. That the example, the model, is Jesus Christ, who stepped down from the glories of heaven and self-sacrificed for us. And that husbands and wives are to self-sacrifice for each other. Now that seemed crazy to the people who first heard it. It was unimaginable that a man in the Roman Empire would do something sacrificial to himself for the benefit of his wife. That here was a model being presented that was the opposite of self-seeking and selfishness. That instead of asking what she can do for me, I ask what I can do for her. I suppose that we could come up with an example of a husband or wife who has given life for a marriage partner. But I'm not sure that would be helpful because it would be so rare. The truth of it is that the self-sacrifice that is discussed here in the Bible is one that is more tied to the ordinary events of life. I think of one couple who mutually agreed that in their marriage, if during the night she wanted a drink of water, that he would get up and get it for her. That if he left the porch light on, that she would get up and she would be the one who would turn it off. Often, the most important sacrifices are the smallest of sacrifices. It's sacrificing an opinion. It's sacrificing an opportunity to get even. It's sacrificing a personal convenience. It is based upon a notion that in marriage, Christians are to seek the desires and pleasure and happiness of the other person. That's certainly true in what the Bible teaches about sexual relationships, that the commitment is not to self-satisfaction, but is to the satisfaction of a marriage partner. In 1 Corinthians 7, the sexual relationship is described saying that the wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Do not deprive each other. And so we begin to get the picture. We begin to imagine a love for each other that is so strong and so committed that she will do anything for him, that he will do anything for her. Not just in theory, but in practice. that if it means for her taking off a little bit early from work and leaving a project behind, that for her, I'll make that sacrifice. That if it means that a marriage partner is concerned about the health problems of smoking or drinking, that I'll do what I need to do in order to stop those things, in order to make that marriage partner happy. If it's a matter of getting up a little bit earlier in the morning when I'd rather sleep in, but he or she wants me to go for a walk or to pray together, that I'll make that sacrifice for the other person's benefit. That the true lover is always asking, always thinking, always choosing, what can I do for her? What can I do for him? And understand that it's not a painful sacrifice for someone that you love. It's a joyful sacrifice. In baseball, there's a sacrifice fly ball. It's true that the batter that hit it is out, but that batter then can advance a teammate to a next base, maybe even by that win the game. It's a joyful sacrifice. If you have a son or daughter who has a major school event, maybe graduation, and you sacrifice one of your vacation days to be with her or him for that day, that's not a painful thing to do. It's a momentous event that you want to be part of. It's a joyful thing to do. If you take $100 out of your savings account in order to buy a special gift for a friend that you have had since kindergarten, it's a sacrifice to be sure, but it's a sacrifice that you want to make. And it's the same with love in marriage. Oh, sure, we could talk about all the potential problems, but let me tell you that the potential pleasures and joys are multiple and great. What could you do to love your wife? What could you do to love your husband sacrificially? What would you give up for the benefit of that person that you love? Understand, however, that it's not sacrifice simply for sacrifice's sake. It is sacrifice that is beneficial. Let's go back to St. Paul, who wrote, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, so that you can make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church, without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless." Again, that the example is Jesus. Jesus who came and died on the cross, not just to do it, but to change us, so that instead of being tainted by sin, we can be holy and blameless. We can be presented to God as saints. He enormously and eternally benefited us. And so husbands and wives are to sacrifice for each other to benefit one another. The benefit means that she encourages him to grow in his faith. It means that he helps her so that she is better at prayer and maybe learns how to pray out loud with him that she couldn't previously do. It is that they push each other to be better followers of Jesus Christ, that they protect one another from sin, that sin does not contaminate either one of them or destroy their relationship. There are couples who grow together spiritually and worship regularly and live righteously and who endure adversity faithfully and do it because they're married to somebody who benefits them, who sacrifices them, who grows them, who changes them, who helps them. I've seen couples go through things that I wouldn't wish upon anybody. Bankruptcy, unemployment, cancer, extramarital affairs, the death of a child. And because of the behavior and love of a marriage partner, the worst of calamities have not only been survived, but they've been able to move beyond them into a stronger and more loving relationship than they ever had before. So that the question at the end of every day and on every anniversary should be, have I loved my husband? Have I loved my wife into a better person than he or she otherwise would have been without my love? Sacrificial, beneficial, and a third mark of Christian love for a husband or wife is to be caring. Ephesians 5:29 says that the love for a spouse is to be like the love for our own bodies. We take care of our bodies. If hungry, what do? We get something to eat. If cold, what do? We put on a coat. If tired, what do? We take a nap or we sleep. We take care of ourselves. And so in a loving Christian marriage, one takes care of the other. It may be care in terms of food, shelter, clothing. In fact, the Bible has some very harsh words to say for those who do not provide for a family member. But caring also includes kind words. One of the things that happens in marriage is that when a couple has been together for a long time, they know better than anyone else the power of a kind word and the destruction of an unkind word. Know exactly what to say and when to say it and how to say it. It's not just a kind or unkind word. It's things like saying thank you. It's laughing at the other person's joke at just the right time, even though you could probably tell the joke better yourself. It's remembering birthdays. It's sitting at a table in a restaurant or at home and waiting that extra minute so that you start the meal together, so that you communicate that the other person is more important to you than what is on the plate. It is a thousand other considerations. It's focusing upon the desire to do your best to fulfill that other person, to make her feel secure, to listen to him when he's got issues that need to be vented. It's calling one another on the phone. It's actually asking, what do you need? What do you want? What can I do for you? Just recently, USA Today reported an interview with best-selling author Stormy Omartian. Her name is Stormy, and parts of her life have been just that. She grew up in a home with a mentally ill mother who regularly locked her up in a closet. As she moved toward adulthood, she had difficult struggles with drugs and with alcohol and got involved in Eastern religions and the occult. And then she went through a disastrous first marriage. She had 2 illegal abortions. She was deeply depressed. She contemplated suicide. But now she is a Christian in her 27th year of marriage with 3 grown children. And she explained what she does to love and care for her husband that makes a difference. She said, something amazing happens to our hearts when we pray for another person. The hardness melts. We become able to get beyond the hurts and forgive. Caring might be praying for the person that you're married to. What is amazing here is that it not only changes the other person, but it changes the person who prays as well. That the hurts can be healed and the forgiveness can come. That the best of Christian love in marriage is sacrificial and beneficial and caring and exclusive. Toward the end of this revolutionary concept of Christian marriage, St. Paul quoted from near the beginning of the Old Testament. It's a quote that Jesus also used. Jesus talked about it in Mark 10 when he said that at the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. St. Paul looked at that, and he thought about it, and he described it as a profound mystery. Something there just aren't enough words to adequately describe, this Christian marriage relationship. There is an intimacy, there is an exclusivity, there is something about it that simply defies an outsider's understanding. There is a permanency given with the seal of God that says that here in this relationship, he can be himself and still be loved. That she can let down her walls and be vulnerable, and she won't be attacked. That they can share secrets together that no one else will ever know, and that not even a court of law will breach spousal privilege. That here in this exclusive relationship, I can grow and be grown. I can be blessed and be a blessing. Oh, it's true that there are all kinds of other relationships that swirl around the marriage. Relationships with parents and children and friends and co-workers, but none like this one. 2 people Two people who understand each other in a way that no one else understands. An intimacy, a secrecy that is for them and for them alone. It is a Christian marriage exclusivity that is to be guarded with an absolute passion. That there is commitment and faithfulness to each other that keeps everyone else out. That there is a bond, a covenant together. That whether the actual words are spoken or not, they both know. They know it well. That my heart, my body, my life belongs to you. And just to you. For better, for worse, for richer, for poorer. In sickness and in health. For the rest of our lives. This is an exclusive Christian love. One of the amazing realities about this Christian love for a marriage partner is that it is not strongest on a wedding day. Oh, some people think that. Some people think that when a man and a woman stand together and speak beautiful words of love and commitment, as rightly they should, that that is the peak of their relationship. It is then that is stronger than at any other time. And the experiences of life then somehow dilute it. But that's not right. That's not the way it was designed to be. Rather, that is only the beginning. As they journey through the varied terrain of life together, they have opportunity after opportunity to discover and love one another in new and different ways that never could have been imagined on that wedding day. It is a love that grows through paying bills and through medical crises, through the changing of addresses, through the birthing of children, through the spending of 10,000 nights together in the same bed, until a marriage relationship and love grows far stronger and more wonderful than when it began. Near the end of the Bible, in the last 50 pages or so, there is an obscure, albeit a very interesting line, written by St. Paul in Titus 2:4, where older women are encouraged to train the younger women to love their husbands. It's a line that we would typically skip in the reading of the Bible. A strange line, that older women are to train the younger women to love their husbands. There seem to be many unspoken assumptions there. There is an assumption that older women know more about love than younger women do, that they've learned lessons that have deepened love in a way that those who are young are yet to experience. There is an assumption here, an assumption that Christian love doesn't just happen, that it needs to be learned, that people need to be trained, that it needs to be practiced and developed. And there's an assumption here that in Christian love, in Christian marriage, the best is always yet to be. So, Christian husband, may your love for your wife be sacrificial, beneficial, caring, and exclusive. And Christian wife, may your love for your husband also be sacrificial and beneficial, caring and exclusive. And to Christians one and all, love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your mind. For Jesus said, this is the first and the greatest commandment, and the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Father God, thank you for your love, and thank you for letting us love each other in the footsteps of your Son, Jesus. I pray today for every marriage, present and future, represented here, that each of these marriages may grow stronger and better by your grace, that each partner may do all that you call that partner to do to make the marriage a success in your sight, and that while the prayer is for their dreams to come true, may it far more be that your dreams for their love and marriage come true all in Jesus' name.